From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Stanley Cup Finals begin today. Ahead on Only a Game, Helene Elliott picks a winner, and you know she'll accurately predict where the chalice will reside for the next year. Also, the Blackhawks send Chicago spirits soaring, and why Indy cars are attracting the women these days. Women drivers, that is. Also, Team USA's slightly inglorious and borderline tipsy World Cup send-off party, and a conversation with the authors of the ESPN World Cup Companion.
There is a proud and remarkable and rich soccer tradition in this country. Going back even to the first World Cup, there's a rare mixed history of American soccer, and I think it's one of the storylines that we've most enjoyed excavating.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Late last night, New England gratefully exhaled. In Game 6 of the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals, the Boston Celtics scored early and often against the Orlando Magic and played solid defense as well. Celtics fans who'd been holding their breaths against the possibility of a collapse began looking forward to the team's 21st appearance in the NBA Finals. After building a 3-0 lead against the Magic, Boston had lost Games 4 and 5, conjuring grisly images of the same sort of collapse the Bruins had imposed on the region in the NHL Conference semifinal series against the Philadelphia Flyers, which Boston had led 3-0. According to experts, the odds of two teams in the same city disintegrating that dramatically in the same spring were roughly 11 to 14 million to 1. But led by Paul Pierce's 31 points and a brilliant cameo appearance by guard Nate Robinson, who scored 13 points in the second quarter, the Celtics dispersed the Magic 96-84. The NBA Finals will begin on Thursday in either Los Angeles or Phoenix. The Lakers currently lead the Suns in the Western Conference Finals 3-2. Those two teams will play Game 6 tonight in Phoenix. No matter which team wins the Stanley Cup this year, it's a fair bet that their fans won't know quite what to do about it. Neither the Blackhawks nor the Flyers have held the cherished chalice chest high and higher in recent memory. Joining me now in order to discuss the process that will engender celebration in either Chicago or Philadelphia is hockey chronicler Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Helene, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much.
How'd you like cherished chalice chest high?
I was very impressed. I know that just came to you in a stroke of like a bolt of lightning, a stroke of genius.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the Chicago Blackhawks are in the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time since 1992, and they haven't won the Cup since 1961. This represents the second longest Cup drought in league history. So, list for us some of the reasons Hawks fans can be optimistic the Cup is coming back.
I think there's a lot of reasons. A guy named Dustin Byfuglien, and if you looked at his name, it's B-Y-F-U-G-L-I-E-N. It's not Byfuglien.
I was going to say, spelled just like it sounds.
Spelled just like you'd think it would be, yeah. He's big, he's wide, he can't be moved from in front of the net. He had a great series in their conference finals against San Jose. He's got line mates who have speed and skill, Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane. The Blackhawks defense seems to have really found its stride. The interesting thing is, you know, you usually think in the NHL that there's some goalie, and I love this image, standing on his head to get his
I love that expression, too.
I know. I picture these legs waving in the air and, you know, just kind of very zen kind of thing there. But neither of these teams really has a superstar goalie. It's really been a team effort for both of them.
It's interesting to me that the National Hockey League's original six are always so thoroughly romanticized, and yet aside from the Detroit Red Wings, none of them have had much recent success, while some of the NHL's original 30 have done quite well. Why is that?
Yeah, I think romanticized is the exact right word, because people think, oh, if Montreal had won, it would have been an original six matchup. Well, if you really go back and look through history, the original six weren't the original six. talk about the Montreal Maroons were there for a long time. There were a lot of other teams that existed early in the NHL's history and disappeared along the way. But you're absolutely right, though, about the Blackhawks having been here, and Montreal getting as far as it did to the conference finals was the first for them since 1993. I mean, teams go in cycles, and you can never predict how things are going to happen. I mean, the Flyers goalie, Michael Layton, he's played for something like 7 different teams, has been traded twice, waived 4 times in his career, including in December, and here he is in the Stanley Cup Finals. You can never predict those things.
The Philadelphia Flyers shocked New Jersey in round one and then staged a historic comeback against another East Coast team in the second round.
We won't be specific,
but
no.
Does this mean that the Flyers are coming into the playoffs with more momentum?
Well, you can make that argument. You know, the Flyers deserve an enormous amount of credit to get this far. I mean, they made the playoffs only on the last day of the season, and to get to the finals is pretty special. But, you know, you look at what Chicago did to San Jose, the supposedly great San Jose Sharks, and you have to respect Chicago. I mean, they just reduced the Sharks to a mewling puddle of goo. I mean,
that's a better image than the goalie standing on his head.
I like Cherish Chalice best of all, but, you know, we'll go with mewling puddle of goo. And
excellent.
I know a lot of San Jose fans are going to be mad, but you know what? Your team didn't win again. Sorry, guys. You had the best point total in the conference, and you got swept. And don't tell me the games were close. A 4-0 series loss is not close.
The Flyers won Stanley Cups back in 74 and 75. They have failed to take home the chalice in 5 subsequent finals. But does this year's team have the necessary qualities to reverse that trend?
I like a lot of things that they have there. I mean, Chris Pronger has become something of a good luck charm, and although there are people in the league who called him far worse than that, he was traded to Edmonton in 2006, and they go to the finals. He was traded to the Ducks, and in 2007, they go to the finals, and they won. This season, the Ducks traded him last summer to Philadelphia, and here the Flyers are in the finals. You need a big, dominant defenseman like that, a shutdown defenseman. And as you say, they have the momentum. They have good leadership. Mike Richards. They have some fresh players, guys who had been injured and came back. And you have examples like Ian LaPerriere, who, I mean, this guy has more stitches in his face than there were in Betsy Ross's flag. I mean, this guy got hit in the face with a puck that you just figure, okay, that's the end of his career. And, you know, the typical hockey player fashion, he bounces back. And there's something there. Plus their coach, Peter Laviolette, coached Carolina to the Cup in 2006. So the guy has experience. He doesn't get rattled. He gets the matchups that he likes. He preaches a very up-tempo kind of game that players love to play. So there's a lot of reasons to look at the Flyers and say, you know what, they could just do this.
All right, it's time to put you on the spot, which I always have to do, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to just contradict me, if you like. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to predict Philadelphia in 7. What do you think?
Ooh, 7.
I like 7. I like those series that go the distance.
Then if it goes the other way in 7, you can say, see, I was just off by 1. Yeah, that worked. I'm going to go with the Blackhawks. I think in 6, I think that ultimately the Blackhawks are deeper. I like the way they've been playing defensively. I think they're very dangerous shorthanded. They have a lot of tools. And I'm just going to go with the Hawks, and I'm curious to see what the reaction will be here. I know the city has really turned on to the Blackhawks the last couple of seasons, and it'd be fun to see this city that's waited for so long and to see guys like Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita watch it and watch this team win.
Helene Elliott covers hockey and baseball and the Olympics for the Los Angeles Times, and we are lucky enough to have her join us from time to time to talk about the NHL. Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
As they prepare to fly even higher than the Flyers, the Blackhawks have recently resembled another bird, the Phoenix. From Chicago, Yolanda Perdomo reports.
Backing the Blackhawks was easy in the 1960s when Here Come the Hawks was the team's song. Superstars Bobby Hull and Sam Mikita hoisted the cup in 1961, the year of Chicago's last Stanley Cup win. The team has traded on nostalgia for decades, and even when the team made the playoffs, it seemed the Hawks were skating uphill.
I remember that he scored. Our goalie was Murray Bannerman. I'm not sure if we won the game or not. I can't remember. But if it was against Edmonton, chances are that we didn't win the game.
Ex-Hawk Peter Marsh describes a large framed picture in his basement of Wayne Gretzky, then of the Edmonton Oilers, scoring a goal against the Hawks in 1982. Chicago made the conference finals that year, but Marsh admits the fans weren't always solidly behind the team. After having endured years of futility and then team owner Bill Wirtz vowing never to televise home games, it gave fans few reasons to follow the Hawks.
Everybody had told Bill Wirtz that you got to put him on TV, but he had made a commitment to his father, Arthur, that he would protect his season ticket holders, and times have changed.
Recently, at the Blackhawks store in downtown Chicago, fans have been snapping up anything with a red and black Indian Head logo. Sometimes columnist Rick Morrissey says as recently as 2007, you couldn't give Blackhawk merchandise away.
It got so bad that it was as if they were selling cancer-causing substances here, you know? I mean, there was nobody here, and I was amazed that it was even in business.
These days, everything sells, from shirts to socks and pucks to pacifiers. Morrissey says new fans should be forgiven for only recently jumping onto the Blackhawks bandwagon.
This is Chicago, and, you know, it's not like there's been a zillion championships here, okay? So I think people should be able to enjoy it while they have it. And if they got on it yesterday and started enjoying it, so what? Who cares?
According to author and team historian Bob Verdi, the decade-by-decade cycle of futility is just part of the Blackhawks' history.
They used to draw huge numbers, the Blackhawks. Then Bobby Hull left in 1972 for the rival league, the Winnipeg Jets, and that was the beginning of some difficult times. A lot of empty seats started showing up at Chicago Stadium. Had a good run in the 80s, but kept running into Wayne Gretzky and the Edmonton Oilers, who were like the, the New York Yankees at that time.
Frank Priscelli smiles like a kid in a candy store walking into the Palace Grill, a hangout for Hawks fans near the United Center. Priscelli started one of the Blackhawks' first fan websites, BlackhawksZone.com, in 1998. He's convinced this is the team's best chance to win the Cup in nearly 50 years and the city's best shot at a title since the White Sox won the World Series in 2005.
Nobody in the city thought the Bears were only going to be one and done in the 80s. Everybody thought they were going to roll through a ton of titles. It just doesn't happen. Somebody could get hurt next year. You never know. This team hasn't won in a long time. The city starved. There's a lot of great players that played for this team that have never won anything. So maybe they could win it for them also.
For Only a Game, I'm Yolanda Perdomo in Chicago.
Here come the Hawks, the mighty Blackhawks. Take the attack.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. If every Fido had an ocean across the USA, then every Bowser'd be surfing like California, or at least like San Diego, where about 60 dogs will be competing in the 5th annual Surf Dog Competition at Imperial Beach today. The event raises money for pet-related charities, which may be pretty much its only redeeming feature, since it will also dress dogs up in board shorts, wetsuits, and life jackets. The owners of the competing dogs are unanimous in their assertion that the dogs enjoy the competition, though at least some of the contestants are said to be worried that the seas will be rough. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Two waggish footy fans break it down World Cup style. But first,
USA! 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 USA!
Several hours before, the U.S. men's soccer team would host the Czech Republic's team at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut on Tuesday night. The parking lot outside the stadium was rocking. Shenanigans had been declared, and two U.S. fans named Jill and Julie were prepared. On their way to the parking lot, they'd stop for supplies. Paper towels, Pepto-Bismol.
And Advil, because I knew somebody won't make it into the stadium.
No.
I've been to these enough to know somebody won't make it into
the
stadium.
Between the alcohol and the heat.
The game would set a house record for soccer, with an official attendance of 36,218. So probably even those chanting, "Let's get drunker," did make it in. The reward for their efforts? In the 17th minute, they saw midfielder Maurice Adu put the U.S. in the lead 1-0. Among those waving flags even after that celebration had concluded were two guys named Eldon and Jasmine. It was the Bosnian flag they were waving, since they were from Bosnia, but they were fans of the game itself.
We just love soccer. It's an amazing sport. I don't know, it just brings energy to us.
But they did have a rooting interest.
Oh, definitely. We live here, we're U.S. fans, so that's our team, that's what we're rooting for.
Unhappily for the U.S. team and their fans, over the next 73 minutes, the Czech team outscored their hosts 4-1, a circumstance that failed to discourage Tyler Fisk, who'd driven down to the game from Conway, Massachusetts.
It's not just the soccer, it's supporting America, you know? It's being here all the time. We went to Giant Stadium twice, 2 years ago and then last year, and now we're back in Connecticut.
Are you going down to Philadelphia?
I did not know they were playing Philadelphia.
Play Turkey in Philadelphia in a couple days.
Well, then we're going down. We're going down.
If he is in Philadelphia for today's game against Turkey, Tyler Fisk will see the team that will actually represent the U.S. in South Africa when World Cup play begins for them in 2 weeks. When Tuesday night's game began, the U.S. roster stood at 30. Coach Bob Bradley had announced that he would not cut his squad to the requisite 23 until after the match. Sports Illustrated soccer writer Grant Wall put that circumstance in perspective.
You've got seven guys who are going to get cut after this first game, and there's been enough injury questions about certain positions that they felt like bringing in 30 players was what they needed to do to see where guys were. But that also makes it a lot more tense in camp because these guys know that their dream of getting to a World Cup, for several of them, it's not going to happen.
The imperative to cut seven players was one reason Coach Bradley left nearly all his stars out of the lineup on Tuesday night. National team stalwarts Landon Donovan, Tim Howard, and Clint Dempsey never appeared in the game. Michael Bradley and celebrated striker Jozy Altidore were likewise spectators. But Tuesday was an active night for Hercules Gomez, who had been out of the national team picture for several years before catching Bradley's eye by scoring 10 goals for Puebla in Mexico's Primera División. When he came into camp, Gomez, who is a non-Herculean 5'10", 165, figured that he was the 30th man on a 30-man squad. Though he knocked in the team's second goal against the Czech Republic, when the game was over, he wondered if anything had changed.
Well, I said I had 29 players in front of me, and my number today was number 30, so that pretty much put it in perspective for me.
Asked if he thought he'd played well enough to make the cut, Gomez could only shrug and hope for the best.
I just did my best, and it's out of my hands now, and, you know, if anything, I'm just proud that I think I gave Bob a little headache now, so hopefully.
In a press conference following the game, Bradley would only say that he and his assistants would order in some food, watch some DVDs of the game, and discuss a number of players. Regarding Hercules Gomez, the coach was giving away very little.
Hercules played his way into the camp with his performance at Puebla based upon goals, and in some cases coming in as a sub and scoring. Here's a guy that was totally out of the picture and played his way back in and certainly will be discussed further tonight.
Just over 12 hours after those unenlightening observations, Coach Bradley stood beside ESPN's Bob Lee as the latter announced the 23rd member of the 23-man squad that will face Turkey today and then head for South Africa.
And playing with Pachuca, he is the first American to lead the Mexican League in scoring, Hercules Gomez. This is your national team for the World Cup.
So, though the game against the Czech Republic on Tuesday didn't count in the sense that it was a friendly, it certainly mattered to Hercules Gomez, who made the team, and to national team veteran Brian Ching, who, to the surprise of many observers, did not. It mattered to the fans, some of whom had come to Connecticut from as far away as Florida and South Dakota to wish their team well at the World Cup, and it mattered a great deal to Sunil Gulati, the president of U.S. Soccer, who used the opportunity to once more bang the drum on behalf of the game he's been promoting for decades.
We're not the same as England or Germany or Brazil. That's going to take more time if we ever get there, right? It's not, the country won't shut down when the U.S. wins or loses a game. That's not going to happen in my lifetime. But if you look at, you know, I'm going to go out there on a limb, I think we'll break some ratings records this summer.
Mr. Gulati may be proved right, especially if the U.S. team can finish first or second in Group C and advance to the knockout stage of the tournament. Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall has some theories about who'll have to excel in order for that to happen.
From an attacking perspective, Landon Donovan and Clint Dempsey have to be those guys, those creative forces for the U.S., because there just aren't that many of them on the field. And they're not the only ones, though, because defensively, the U.S. is going to face a lot of pressure from England and other big-name teams, potentially. So Tim Howard in goal is going to need to come up big.
Names with which to conjure those three, stars in their respective leagues in the U.S. and the U.K. But for anyone who was paying attention to a game that didn't count on Tuesday night, a game in which a guy who was a couple of strides short of long shot to make the team until very recently, it's impossible not to wonder if perhaps South Africa will provide a stage upon which one Hercules Gomez might shine. The U.S. will begin World Cup play on Saturday, June 12th, against England, whom we'll profile on next week's program. Just in time for the World Cup, and to the surprise of almost nobody, ESPN has produced the World Cup Companion, subtitled Everything You Need to Know About the Planet's Biggest Sports Event. The history is here, and so are the triumphs, the disappointments, and the scandals. Joining me now to discuss the book are its co-authors, David Hershey and Roger Bennett. Gentlemen, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having us on, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Roger, in the introduction, you guys characterize the World Cup as, quote, the greatest soap opera in sports. Make the case for that distinction.
It's very easy to do so. The backstories to the World Cup attract the thinking of both philosophers and tabloid journalists. It's the ultimate high culture, low culture frenzy in which 22 men run around the pitch for 90 minutes in polyester shorts, blithely unaware of the socio-cultural and political weight of the ramification of their exertion. And I think at the end of the day, that's what our book is about. You have to understand the ramifications, the backstories. Otherwise, watching the World Cup without them is a little bit like being invited to watch Lost in the middle of season three.
David, like a lot of signature sports events, the World Cup wasn't always the big deal that it is today. In fact, England, the country that gave soccer to the world, didn't even send a team to the first several tournaments. Why not?
Well, I think, you know, England has always felt that as the inventors of the game, it's their birthright to win the tournament. And they just didn't feel like it merited their inclusion, I guess, early on. Ever since, of course, each team they field is going to win the World Cup. Amazingly, it's only happened once in the last 40 years.
Besides providing a chronological history of the tournament, the book presents a series of men you've identified as, quote, cult figures of the World Cup. The caption beside a photo of one of these characters reads, a rare photo of Giuseppe Meazza with his pants on. Explain,
well,
please.
Yeah, well, I wrote that one. You know, everybody has their own idiosyncratic training regimen. Meazza's was essentially to wake up the morning of a game in a brothel next to a couple of women that he had met the night before and take a taxi to the stadium. The reason they forgave him is that he was such a consummate technician. They let him basically do his own thing off the field. Not unlike, you know, some of the later day heroes like Maradona and others.
Mr. Miazza is said to have shown up at one game still wearing his pajamas. At least one game.
Well, you know, who among us doesn't do that, though?
I hadn't realized until I read the World Cup Companion how often fixes and bribes had figured in past tournaments. Please start with the deal Benito Mussolini worked with Greece in 1934 to improve the prospects of Italy's team.
He made sure that the World Cup came to Italy. He made sure that Italy would win at all costs. And in a critical qualifying game, he'd been building stadia all over the country, incredibly beautiful, pioneering Italian neo-architectural buildings. Italy needed the points to get there, and so he pretty quickly sent his builders across to Greece. They constructed a stunning headquarters for the Greece football authorities. Greece rolled over. Referees were so biased, apparently, in this tournament that one of them headed the ball across the face of goal to a waiting Italian striker to prod home. And to nobody's surprise, Italy were victorious, and they gave Mussolini the victory that he so craved. What is surprising is that in 1938, they went away from Italy, and were booed by 10,000 anti-fascist protesters who booed their every move. Mussolini dictated to his team that they would have to stand in the Mussolini-esque salute before games while they were being jeered, quote, until the protesters run out of energy to scream. Against all odds, they won the World Cup again, and the World Cup weathered the war in a shoebox under the bed of the head of the Italian football authorities, who were so terrified that Mussolini was going to melt it down into gold bullion.
Roberto Baggio's manager at Fiorentina said of his star, "Angels sing in his legs." But I guess even this pales next to the newspaper headline addressed to Salvatore Toto Schillaci after his exceptional performance during the 90 World Cup. Could you read that one for us?
The headline in Italy's tabloids was, "Toto, we desire you physically." Toto Schillaci came out of nowhere. He came out of the would be in America the equivalent of single-A baseball, to become the surprise star of the 1990 World Cup. And all across Italy, people were naming their children after him. So, you know, today there are lots of 20-year-olds named Toto in Italy who have bulging eyes and a good right foot.
The U.S. team met with President Obama and former President Clinton on Thursday as part of their send-off to the World Cup. Besides Mr. Mussolini and Mr. Obama, lots of leaders of various nations have associated themselves with teams headed to the World Cup. Which leaders have most greatly benefited from that association?
The Argentina Junta, I think in 1978, Argentina won the World Cup in their own backyard. There were several controversial moments where the referee would look over at the sidelines and see all the helmeted police and armies, and I think gave the Argentinians the benefit of the doubt.
In 2002, George Bush II gave the World Cup probably one of its most cryptic presidential moments, when a team very much like this one that had no stars, was egoless, was highly organized, shocked the world by going on an ambitious run. And George Bush phoned the American team up in their locker room. They all gathered around the phone to hear an inspirational message. And the best he could come out with was, "A lot of people like me who don't know anything about soccer in this country are rooting for you guys." They all looked at each other, shrugged. I think they guessed it was a compliment.
When I started in this business, the sports editor said to me, "Don't waste your time on this sport, kid. It's a game for commie pansies." Well, all I can say is that there are now 4.3 million registered commie pansies playing the sport.
I'm speaking with the authors of the ESPN World Cup Companion, and you're listening to Only a Game. I know you guys have collected a lot of World Cup-related music, which you write about in the book. Here's one of Germany's greatest players, Franz Beckenbauer, singing a 1966 song titled "Good Friends Are Never Separated."
Du allein soll
sein. Du allein siehst in meine Seele.
Do you suppose that the friends of whom Mr. Beckenbauer sings were Team England?
It's hard to tell, to be honest, but this is an epic song, and I promise you, it's a very dangerous song. It's one of the most contagious pieces of music that you could possibly broadcast on National Public Radio. Your listeners are going to be humming that part Donovan, part Hasselhoff, little whispered song all afternoon, I guarantee it. He was a rock star in post-war Germany, a Germany that was deeply impoverished, was confused about its own identity. Then along he came, using the World Cup as his platform to announce himself to the rest of the world, revolutionising the game by attacking from a deep defensive position. It was only fitting that he recorded a single because he was kind of the first post-war German rock star.
Finally, guys, you've done all the historical research. Did it give you any sense of which team is likely to win it all this year?
I'm looking forward to seeing Brazil. It's going to be a very different Brazil to the mythical Brazil who play the Circus du Soleil kind of flamboyant football. I'm excited to see all of the African teams take the pitch as the World Cup comes to that continent for the first time. And it's going to be very interesting to see which of the teams is going to be inspired by 100,000 screaming vuvuzelas on towards victory. But most of all, Bill, I'm looking forward to seeing New Zealand, the ultimate pub team. And when you watch New Zealand, it could be you. It could be me, it could be David taking to the field. They're almost an amateur team in their shambolic nature. And if they score a single goal, that will be akin to their victory.
My dark horse is Holland. They've come close in 74 and 78. And I think finally they have achieved the sort of mental stability that has eluded them and will make a run for it.
David Hershey and Roger Bennett are the co-authors of the ESPN World Cup Companion, Everything You Need to Know About the Planet's Biggest Sports Event. It's an ESPN book, and the co-authors join me from NPR in New York. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me on.
And Roger, many thanks.
Thanks, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
For a time last week, Google's homepage featured an abbreviated but operative version of the 1980s video game Pac-Man. The game's miniature comeback proved successful to the tune of 4.82 million hours of time spent at play rather than at work. At least according to Rescue Time blog, which calculated that the total loss of productivity amounted to over $120 million. Of course, as at least one economist hungry for attention has pointed out, those calculations were based on the assumption that if they hadn't been fooling around with Pac-Man, those thousands of people would have been selling, buying, or computing rather than sleeping, daydreaming, or checking baseball scores. Not that anybody here would ever do that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, more ladies than ever before prepare to start their engines in Indianapolis. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
While we're talking about drivers of the female persuasion and otherwise, have you a pick for Sunday's Indy 500?
Well, it's easy to pick the Indianapolis 500 every year, Bill, because you've been dealing with essentially the same five or six surnames for the last 70 years, so you just kind of decide whose turn it is. No, actually, I believe, and here's an outside, I think Scott Dixon is going to win the race.
Okay.
He won in 2008. I think he's starting in sixth position. I think he's in pretty good shape. I think he's my pick to win the race.
The Lakers topped the Suns on Thursday night for a 3-2 lead in the NBA's Western Conference Finals. The unlikely hero of the night award goes to Ron Artest. Is that a misprint?
A little bit of a piece of redemption. The signing of Ron Artest looked like a really good deal for the Lakers at the beginning of the season. It has not turned out that way. But then he gives the Lakers 103-101, gives them a lead going back to Phoenix, and now all of a sudden he's the darling of all those fans who, as the wire service story says, pining for Trevor Ariza, which I can tell you, if you're pining for Trevor Ariza, you don't have much to pine for in your life.
Mm. The Cleveland Cavaliers fired their coach this week, Charlie, so now LeBron James is sure to stay, right?
Absolutely, because I'm sure that's what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very quick trigger, of course, on behalf of the Cavs. Right now, their entire franchise is geared around what's going to happen with LeBron James, and I think Mike Brown just got caught as part of that shuffle.
Michael Guerin, the owner of the Atlanta Hawks, has been fined $25,000 for violating the NBA's anti-tampering rules. Earlier this week, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban was fined $100,000 for doing essentially the same thing. I forget the name of the player with whom Mr. Guerin and Mr. Cuban tampered. Help me out with this.
Both of them were fined for publicly admitting that they wouldn't mind having LeBron James on their team. I want to be the one owner who says, I can't use this guy.
Where would I put him?
He's never won anything, and I've got players here. I don't need this guy.
Where would I put him?
Let him go somewhere else.
After a 15-month investigation, the NCAA has accused the University of Connecticut men's basketball program of 8 violations. UConn had tried to get ahead of this scandal earlier this week by announcing that the two assistant coaches accused of the most serious allegations had resigned.
Oh, good.
But now it looks as if the scandal or whatever it is might reach further than that.
Yeah, the NCAA is notoriously unimpressed by the number of obscure bodies you throw off the train in an attempt to throw them off the scent. Jim Calhoun is in big trouble on this one. This is a major, major scandal there. And the fact that the NCAA is still citing them anyway after they gave them the pound of flesh they wanted, it can bode nothing good.
You have been consistent in your support of Original Six NHL teams,
yeah,
Charlie.
I know.
Does this mean you're rooting for the Blackhawks to beat the Flyers in the Stanley Cup Finals?
I do, because I also just came back from Chicago when Blackhawk fever is running amok.
Excellent.
All in Chicago. This is actually an Original 12 matchup. You know, this is the Flyers were the second generation, of course, one of the sparkling franchises, actually, of the original expansion. At the very least, you're going to see a lot of really cool Bobby Hull highlights on the telecasts.
We have talked previously, of course, about the great start enjoyed by the Tampa Bay Rays, at least until they got swept by the Red Sox this week. But now it's time for a tip of the Only a Game cap to pitcher Ubaldo Jimenez of the Colorado Rockies for the start that he's having, don't you think?
He's 9-1. He's got 16 1/3 scoreless innings. His ERA is now under 1, which is, needless to say, the best in baseball. But more to the point, he's doing it in Denver, which is a pitcher's graveyard. So, yes, he is without question going to start the All-Star game. And if you're looking for early line favorites for the Cy Young Award, it's him and nobody else.
On Monday, the Supreme Court decided against the National Football League in a case having to do with who could sell stuff bearing team logos. Is this a case with implications for caps and keychains exclusively, or does it go beyond that?
No, the NFL failed in trying to get the antitrust immunity that's granted to baseball because it has a specific exemption. This will also come to hurt the NBA and the NHL, neither of whom have the similar exemption either. This, to me, is the biggest defeat for a major sports league in an awfully long time. And the fact that it was a unanimous decision coming from the most pro-corporate Supreme Court of our lifetime says a lot.
Meanwhile, the NFL acknowledged this week that the 2014 Super Bowl might be postponed by bad weather. Boy, they must have a really good forecaster.
Gee, we're going to play it outdoors in the upper latitudes in winter in a stadium with no roof on it. What could possibly go wrong?
It might snow.
It might actually snow, at the very least.
In New York, at the very least,
it's going to snow enough so traffic will be a nightmare and people will be going to the 2014 Super Bowl until 2019.
Pat Tillman, who was killed in Afghanistan after leaving the National Football League to become a U.S. Army Ranger, started his career at Arizona State University, and it was announced this week for his time there, he will be enshrined in the College Football Hall of Fame. Good pick for Memorial Day.
That's a very, very nice touch by the College Football Hall of Fame.
The U.S. State Department issued a warning yesterday to those who might wish to travel to next month's World Cup in South Africa. Is this a matter of the government covering its bases, or should I stop trying to land that ticket for the U.S. v. England on June 12th?
This is something that our government now announces anytime anybody's going overseas, let alone high-profile targets. So, and FIFA, who, of course, we take everything FIFA says at face value, says it has no credible threats, had been undercover by any intelligence agency that had been working with it. I think you should be wary. South Africa is very politically unstable, but I think that people who have the ticket should probably go anyway.
In a preemptive strike of sorts, trade unions in Great Britain have asked companies to allow their employees to watch England's World Cup games while they're on the clock, because if they don't, the workers are going to call in sick and watch them anyway. Good solution to a potential problem?
Yeah, not bad, except they are leaving one loophole, because they really have to allow for following day hangovers. They're only going part way to address the obvious productivity problems.
So they're not, the unions aren't asking for these guys to have permission to watch and drink on the job.
No, they just want to watch on the job. But
my understanding of the news out of Buenos Aires is that we now have a really solid reason to hope that Argentina does not win another World Cup. Have I got that right?
Yes, Diego Maradona has promised he will run naked through the center of Buenos Aires if Argentina wins the World Cup.
I do hope that if
Argentina does win and he does run, he places the hand of God strategically as he does so.
Mm-hmm. We haven't really had much chance or cause to chat about the women's pro soccer season, Charlie, but I think it only right to mention that St. Louis Athletica has folded, causing the league to have to remake the entire schedule for the remainder of the season. I guess this is not one of those cases where any publicity is good publicity.
My question is, what is going to happen to the players? Apparently they're
still
eligible for the All-Star game. Will they represent a team that is no longer there?
Well, my understanding actually is they'll only be eligible for the All-Star game if, through the dispersal draft, they land on another team.
They play well enough. Yeah,
exactly. I know you like basketball, Charlie, and I'm pretty sure you like pizza.
I hunger for the playoffs.
How did you respond this week to the opportunity to buy a pizza with your favorite team's logo on it?
The one thing that does bother me about it costs $5 more for the pizza if you happen to have the Celtics in it.
Of course it does.
Of course, I wonder if you buy one that has the Cleveland Cavaliers logo in it, do you choke on it?
It costs $3 less.
Exactly.
All right, I know how you feel about people getting elected to Halls of Fame. You're fine with letting them all in. But what was your response when the Baseball Hall of Fame announced that they would enshrine the John Fogerty song, Center Field?
I think the fact that with a guy with a back catalog like John Fogerty, to have center field be his more prominent thing, outside of John Lennon being remembered for that awful Imagine, this is really terrible. I hate this song, but then again, I hate a lot of people in the Baseball Hall of Fame, so I guess it's very consonant with my lifelong aversion to it.
Perfect. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week in center field. I mean, at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Last week's program featured a story about the career of Diego Maradona, in which the reporter said that fans in Argentina all remembered where they were when Maradona scored the so-called goal of the century against England in 1986, just as people of a certain age in the U.S. remember where they were when they learned of the assassination of President Kennedy. Of that analogy, Bob Manning, who hears Only a Game on WFPL in Louisville, wrote, "Ian Mount's piece was utterly spoiled in the first sentence. Using President Kennedy's assassination as a hook in a sports story was in deplorably bad taste." Annie Crone Rosenstein emailed this week to say, "Thank you for all the great NASCAR coverage this morning. No, I'm not being sarcastic. I really am a Cambridge-living, book-reading, Democrat-voting NASCAR fan. I love your show, but always wish there was more NASCAR coverage. It's hard to find. We're revving up more on NASCAR and IndyCars, too, so stay tuned for that." Frank Burdick, who hears the program on WVBR in Ithaca, New York, was not similarly delighted by our motorsport story. "Why never lacrosse?" he asked. "It is the fastest growing sport in the country, with far more fans than NASCAR pit crew racing." Listeners who tune in more than somewhat will know that various matters in sports drive me to doggerel. Of that occasional tendency, Melinda Robbins wrote, "On paper, his poems are tolerable and maybe even more, but to the ear, they're horrible and certainly a bore." It's the first time I've been ripped in rhyme. Several listeners responded with posts on our Facebook page this week, among them Simon Young, who enjoyed my conversation with Howard Bryant about his new biography of Henry Aaron. "I love the distinction between Mr. Aaron and that person Bonds, Henry Aaron as the standard bearer rather than the record holder." You too can reach us through our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio, where you can also see photos of various landlubbers on our staff rolling on the Charles River, rowing a boat that's perhaps never been so inefficiently propelled. Among the tweets we received this week was this one from Jeffrey Bramhall, who follows us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Thanks for being the best thing about waking up on Saturdays and for having a podcast for early a.m. bike rides. All those social networking options aside, perhaps the easiest way to reach us is still through the website, onlyagame.org. You can also leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Two of the highest-profile auto races on the planet take place tomorrow. Each Memorial Day weekend, fans flock to the Indianapolis 500 and NASCAR's Coca-Cola 600 held in Charlotte, North Carolina. In Indianapolis, the field will include a record number of women drivers. There won't be any female drivers in the NASCAR race. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff reports.
When Sarah Fisher set out to qualify for this year's Indianapolis 500, she had the chance to make history.
Sarah Fisher bringing it home right now. Average speed 224.434.
And with that run, Fisher became the fourth woman to earn a spot in this year's Indy 500. The others are Danica Patrick, Simona DiSilvestro, and Anna Beatrice. That's more women than ever before in an Indy 500 field. Terry Angstad is with the Indy Racing League.
We think it's a fantastic development in our business. We established diversity as one of our brand attributes 3 years ago.
Now contrast that with what happened Thursday night in NASCAR. 47 drivers tried to qualify for the Coca-Cola 600. All of them were men. So why the difference? Ray Evernham has a theory. The former NASCAR crew chief and team owner says up until the last few years, the Indy Racing League has been seen as more female-friendly than NASCAR.
We were kind of looked at as that southern good old boy sport. You know, you get yourself a T-shirt and you got grease on your hands and all that stuff, and it's not that way anymore, and I think there's a lot of girls that see that.
Fisher agrees. She says it takes years to get enough experience to drive in any top-level series, and the women who've put in that time right now just happen to be in the Indy Racing League.
Well, I think that the girls who, you know, targeted racing 10 years ago, you know, wanted to compete in the Indianapolis 500, and, you know, now there's more girls who are in midget racing and sprint car racing who want to go, you know, race the stock car NASCAR world.
Evernham once hired a young female racer named Erin Crocker to drive in NASCAR. She had made a name for herself driving winged sprint cars on dirt tracks. But once in NASCAR, she struggled.
Jason Edleski in the 75 got turned around.
See a lot of damage to that 98 car right there of Erin Crocker. A lot of damage to that Evernham Dodge.
Evernham and Crocker would later marry. Despite that close relationship, when Evernham lost sponsorships, Crocker found herself out of NASCAR. Her prospects of getting back in don't look good.
You know, I tried for a while to get another opportunity in the Truck Series or ARCA, but it's just really hard. I mean, it's hard for any driver. There's not many opportunities out there. The economy's not great. I haven't necessarily totally given up on it, but I'm not trying to fight for it like I was.
Evernham says the competitiveness of NASCAR has made it very difficult for any young driver, male or female, to break through. He doesn't think it's that way in Indy racing.
It's great that there's four girls running Indy. It'll attract, you know, more women, letting them know that there's chances to make it. But taking that route right now, I think your chances are better.
Angstad with the Indy Racing League says he agrees that it is easier for women to be successful in the IRL right now than in NASCAR. Another reason for the discrepancy is that Indy cars appear easier to transition into than stock cars. Compared to Indy cars, stock cars are bigger, heavier, clumsier, and slower. And few who didn't grow up racing stock cars have been successful once inside one. One driver who's made that transition successfully is Casey Kane, but he says it was not easy.
Our cars just take time to learn. It takes time to work with the right people and get that feeling for our tires and the way that our cars handle, and so you just need that time.
Fisher has driven both stock cars and Indy cars. She admits that stock cars are very different to drive, but it doesn't mean that those in NASCAR are more talented.
No. I think they both have their own, you know, level of technique. They're both own strategies, and, you know, one is completely different than the other. So, you know, taking that into mind, I don't think that one's harder than the other.
The trend of female drivers racing in the IRL isn't expected to end anytime soon. Young, talented women race regularly in lower-level open-wheel series, and all the attention Danica Patrick receives isn't hurting either. But Evernham says in NASCAR, it's likely to be a while before women break through. He recently sold his race team and now owns a local dirt track near Charlotte where NASCAR hopefuls show up each weekend.
On an average, we get about 75 to 80 cars that come in to run our five classes over there. But out of those, you know, only two of them are girls.
While NASCAR has a diversity program to encourage participation by females and minorities, a spokesman admits it's not yet where the sport wants it. And as this weekend's races will show, it's at least one area where NASCAR has some catching up to do. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
She's racing cars on the left, she's racing cars on the right. Oh, well, she's dragging in the morning, in the afternoon, and at night. A little hot pride, Susie, little hot pride, Susie, move on.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabue. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from soccer fan Sean Samayo, who was asked if he had purchased his tickets for South Africa.
I haven't because I just got married, and I think the honeymoon was enough. But if anyone has any extra tickets, find me on the internet.
He hasn't quite given up on the dream, has he? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at WallaceFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.